New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you're a New England sports fan of a certain age, chances are you can describe exactly what happened during Game 6 of the 1986 World Series when Bill Buckner missed a roller at first.
Little roller up along first, behind the bag, it gets through Buckner, here comes Knight and the Mets win it!
That error allowed the Mets a winning run and further cemented the curse of the Bambino in the minds of Red Sox fans. Many of those same fans still get weepy when thinking of 2004, when the Sox finally reversed the curse and won the World Series. But along with the swells of pride comes the agony. Just ask any Bruins fan who watched Boston's 2-1 lead in Game 6 of the Stanley Cup Finals squandered by two Blackhawks goals in the last 76 seconds of the game. Sorry. Too soon? We spoke to science writer and Radiolab contributor Eric Simmons before the Bruins' crushing defeat. Eric's latest book, The Secret Lives of Sports Fans, is his attempt to figure out the science and psychology of those whose passion for sports quickly tips into fanaticism. And it begins with his own play-by-play of a heartbreak.
In order to really explain this to people, you need to understand how painful and how miserable this is. And this is a very easy memory for me to select because this is like 6 years later now. And this still, I'm like shaking in the studio now because it still agitates me. So I'm sitting there in the California Memorial Stadium in Berkeley, which is this beautiful stadium, you know, just this great view across the bay. And it's in Strawberry Canyon. It's a gorgeous place. And my beloved Cal football team, which I have been going to games since I was 4 months old. My dad dragged me out there on his shoulders. We are watching the number two ranked team in the country, our team, which has never won anything. Like, they're always just falling short, or, you know, they haven't been to the Rose Bowl since the 1950s. They haven't won the Rose Bowl since like the 1930s or something. This is one of those things that, you know, you just never quite expect to happen in your lifetime. I'm sure everybody in the New England area like is like, oh yeah, I've been there.
Yeah.
And so we're sitting there and our team is ranked number two and the number one team has lost. And they are playing a pretty poor game against a not very good team, but they're coming back and they make this inspired comeback. And this place is just going nuts. Like, everybody is standing and they're driving down the field with like 10 seconds left. The ball's on the 8-yard line. This is so manifest that they are going to score and win this game and be the number one ranked team in the country. And this thing that we've been longing for is going to happen. And they screw it up. Just like out of nowhere, they screw it up in the worst possible way, where like the most obvious thing that the 18-year or 19-year-old quarterback, he's a kid and he makes a bad decision. And like, yeah, of course, like 19-year-olds make bad decisions sometimes, but he makes a bad decision and we just lose it. How does this happen? And you can talk to anybody who is there or anybody who's watching and we all have this just like, oh my God, it was like the most painful thing ever. And I remember him screwing up and they lose the game by 3 points even though they were right there and they should have not lost. And the coach is throwing his headset on the ground because it's just like this normally placid guy has lost it too. And everybody is standing there and I'm standing there with my hands on my head, just jaw dropped in horror. And then I remember after the game, going into San Francisco, and it's probably, you know, about dinner time for a fashionably late dinner, and everybody on the train's kind of dressed up, and they're going for cocktails, and just, you know, it's the San Francisco food scene, and it's dressy and classy, and I'm sitting here, and I'm, like, crammed in the corner of the train, and I'm wearing my Cal hat, which after, like, 4 hours starts to, like, restrict my head, and my head's been pulsing anyway because of all the excitement, and so I'm just sitting there, like, with a headache, and I had for dinner, like, a boiled hot dog, and all these people are all dressed up, and it's like, what is wrong with me? So there's where the book comes from.
Well, you describe this kind of feeling, like, you know, that rises within us of, you know, like, yeah. I don't know, erupting outside of us. And I wonder, do you have any comparisons to that emotion? Is any other equivalency in your life?
Not in my life. I mean, I think this is one of the puzzling things for me is that I don't write about sports very often. I usually write about the environment and nature and these kind of things. I love hiking and the outdoors, and I think of myself as this fairly calm person, and I have a very calm kind of relationship. And then I go to things like this, and I just lose it, and it feels like I'm possessed. It's not even me anymore. It's this, you know, insane demon raging beast going on in there. And so that's what I just puzzles me to no end. And so that's where I went.
Well, you find that that actually has a lot to do with what's going on in the endocrine system of a super fan. What's happening in the body of a sports fanatic?
This is really kind of amazing. You have all these hormones changing all the time in response to life. But one of the things it looks like is that your hormones, and in particular in men, your testosterone, is responding to this game as if you were actually playing in it. There's pretty good evidence that when you win a competition of any kind, you know, you win a game of chess, your testosterone will go up. And there's pretty good evidence that if you lose a competition, your testosterone will go down. I mean, this has been studied all up and down animals and not just people. But the idea that not just me competing, but me watching other people compete when I'm not involved at all. I mean, I don't know any of these kids. I don't know any of the players who play professionally. I probably wouldn't like them if I did know them. But all the same, my testosterone probably is going up when they win, and it's probably depressed when they lose, not through anything I control. And, you know, if you know a little bit about testosterone, it's tied to increased aggression, kind of, you know, increased belligerence, you might say. It's very much a kind of dominance in social hormone. And this is going up without your ability to control it, just because you're watching other people's testosterone going up, really, to me, is kind of remarkable.
Eric Simmons is with us. His new book is called The Secret Lives of Sports Fans. And it's his attempt to get at the root of fandom, this sometimes enlivening, sometimes appalling display of irrational behavior around sports. Now, this isn't just happening in the endocrine system. It also affects us neurologically. Tell us about the role that mirror neurons play.
One thing I was really interested in is this feeling that all sports fans have about anticipation. And a lot of, you know, when oh, my God, I knew that was going to happen. Those guys always blow it. Well, a lot of that is obviously hindsight bias. But some of it appears to be not. And it gets at kind of the heart of this reaction we're having in our brain in these really quite incredible little neurons that they've discovered in the last 15 or so years called mirror neurons. And these are, they argue, kind of the root of a lot of our empathy and our understanding of other people. And what they see in them is that they turn on whether we are conducting an action ourselves, whether we're planning and engaging in action, whether we are watching someone else do the action, whether we're just reading about the action, it seems, when we just hear the word for the action, we are having these same neurons turn on. And so the argument that extends from this is that when we see someone else do something, we don't need to think about it to understand what they want, to understand what they're doing. We can see someone kick a soccer ball. I can see someone hit a hockey puck. And I can instantly understand, because I'm running this simulation in my brain of exactly what I would do if I were hitting the hockey puck, if I were kicking the soccer ball. There's a pretty good study of basketball players, and they talk about rebounds, and the advantage that professional basketball players have is their ability to anticipate a shot that's going to be missed before it's even in the air, because they can read the body language so well of the other player, of the shooter, that they know this is going to miss. And there's a big competitive advantage to having good mirror neurons in basketball, because you can go get this rebound. And so I kind of applied that to a lot of sports where you're anticipating something, where you see the action. And this, I mean, this applies in part to why we emote so much around sports, because we really deeply understand what's happening.
But how about heartbreak? How about pride? Why do we stick with teams that keep breaking our hearts?
Right. This is my favorite question of all. I think it really does actually parallel love. You know, there are bad breakups where you look back and there were still rewarding moments in there. And a lot of the end of a season is for most people, is kind of a bad breakup with the team. It's like, we're done now for 3 months or 4 months or the off season. You know, I talk about Cleveland quite a bit in the book, because that's the place where you ask this question of why do you come back when you know that these things are challenging your self-control, when you know that this is going to change your testosterone and your empathy and your group behavior, and you still come back. Well, what's the reward? And, you know, for people whose teams have won recently or who are going to win, you know, well, it's obviously what the reward is. It makes you happy. But for the people whose teams don't win, well, there's got to be some other reward out there that means something to us. And that's exactly it. This is actually a really good source of identity for people, that is more important in some sense than just the happiness you get from winning and losing. That my ability to say I'm a Cleveland Indians fan is really important to me. And that makes it worth sticking with the losing. That makes all the little testosterone and the depression and the frustration makes it worth it. And the ability to kind of be in this loving relationship and have your identity protected by the Indians and be in love with them makes up for a lot of heartbreak.
I'm wondering, Eric Simmons, with the piece of your soul belonging to the San Jose Sharks, did working on this book actually help you regain any free will over your fandom writing this book?
No. No, I'm just as hopeless as ever. I think I went into the book a little bit mad that these guys have such power over me. And I think that understanding a little bit kind of where the power comes from and understanding that really, even in the frustration, there's good stuff in there. You know, that's important in every relationship. It's important in most of your jobs to understand that there's going to be some level of frustration and you have to figure out what's meaningful about it and just work with that. And I think I've moved into that stage of my relationship with the Sharks. They fail me every year. I deal with it. But I understand what I get out of them and that they do bring me some happiness and joy along the way and some meaning. So I appreciate that is what I'm telling you.
Eric Simmons' new book is called The Secret Lives of Sports Fans. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, yeah, my pleasure.
Now, you can find more on this title and Eric's previous book, which is Darwin Slept Here, at wordofmouthradio.org. Musical Annie opened yesterday evening at the Prescott Park Arts Festival in Portsmouth. More than 60 dogs barked their way through an open audition for the role of Sandy, little orphan Annie's lovable and loyal canine sidekick. Producer Zach Nugent went to the Sandy Search to get a look at the talent and a glimpse at the next big thing in little dogs.
From the top, a 5, 6, 7, 8.
The world of auditioning has always been synonymous with anxiety, stress, and that ultra-competitive hunger for the part.
God, I hope I get it. I hope I get it. How many people does he need?
So it's refreshing to arrive at the Sandy auditions and see 60-plus dogs joyfully running around, wagging and slobbering uncontrollably. The only hunger here is for dog treats, which there are plenty of. Billy Butler, the director of Annie, is one of the judges for the audition.
I'm looking for that, you know, that special spark, you know, that's something. You know, the dog with a twinkle in its eye, you know. To me, I'll really look to the owner because their personality will reflect what the dog's like too, so.
And if these dog owners are reflections of their dogs, I don't think they have anything to worry about, for the most part.
He's very, special.
Silly, goofy. He's my Rasta man.
He drills a considerable amount. He's wearing a bib. A friend of mine got it for him. It says Chick Magnet on it.
He's very outgoing. He has a great personality. At least people tell me he has a great personality.
He's usually pretty gentle. He's very friendly. Sometimes he gets a little excited, and then things tend to get broken.
She's madly in love with every other dog.
He's shy. He is a little bit of, he's a little bit of a chicken.
She's a princess. She wants everything her own way.
He's mellow and sweet and loving and very motivated by food, any kind of food.
As the auditions start, one thing becomes clear. Out of the four judges, there's one who seems to be enjoying herself a little more than the others.
Are you excited about today?
Yes!
Why?
Because, like, I get to see a bunch of dogs and I get to pet them and be so cute. And I have a dog right over there and she's adorable and now I get to see 83 dogs. Wow.
That number is debatable, but her enthusiasm isn't. This is Carly Gendel. She'll be playing the role of Annie and she's a critical part of the audition process. Each dog will be judged on how they interact with her. Do they shy away when she hugs them? Do they come when she calls them? Watching all these interactions is Sue Carney. She's a local dog trainer and the resident dog expert. She was asked to help judge the competition, hopefully seeing hidden signs of greatness or potential disaster.
I think the ultimate goal is to get a dog that has a spark, as well as can handle the sparks that are around it. I think lights and singing and clapping and all the different days that the play's on, the dog has to be able to deal with all of that.
Okay. That's right.
I'm just going to go through what I really, really like. Very young but adorable is Maggie.
As the day goes on and the judges narrow down the field, spirits stay high. Even for those like Linda and Rupert experiencing the harsh reality of defeat.
Well, I think
come feeling a little dejected. But you know what? I think I'm going to get over it. Because there was a fear that I might win, and then I'd have to actually get him there every night. And then a handler and the photos, it would just go to his head. So I think we're better off.
How's
so.
He feeling?
He feels that he wants to really play ball.
As the final round of auditioning ends, the judges huddle around, quietly comparing notes. There's only 5 dogs left at this point, but a crowd has gathered around to watch, anxious for the final announcement.
And a drum roll, please. Do you want to announce
the...
Do you want to announce the winner?
Yes! And the winner is... Broccoli!
Well, his name is technically not Broccoli.
His name is Buckley, but I call him Broccoli because it's way more better.
Whatever you want to call him, being Sandy may have always been his fate. Here's his owner, Gene Kane.
Well, I didn't know anything about this.
Oh, you didn't?
And Buckley comes here every day, early in the morning and at night. So we came in this morning and someone said, oh, are you here to have Buckley try out? And I said, for what? And they said, well, to be an Annie. And I said, no, but we could think about it. And I actually took my granddaughter to Annie in New York 2 weeks ago. And she came out and said, Buckley should have been the dog. And he's the next Sandy.
And if Buckley's ever feeling under the weather, he'll have an understudy. Here's director Billy Butler.
Our star is Buckley, named after, William F. Buckley, I believe his name is. And the other one is whiskey, which is great, because I believe that William F. Buckley drank whiskey.
But in all seriousness, there's something uplifting about spending a day with a bunch of happy and joyful dogs, and it washes over everyone.
It was great. Played all day with dogs. I mean, I'm really surprised at how friendly the dogs were, and like I said, you know, to all the parents of the dogs, it says a lot about them as people. It gives me a little glimmer of hope.
And for those dogs who had their sights set on the spotlight but left with their tail between their legs, there's always, well, you know.
Bet your bottom dollar that tomorrow there'll be sun.
For Word of Mouth, I'm Zach Nugent.
Just thinking about tomorrow clears away the cobwebs and the sorrow.
If you missed Carly Buckley and the rest of the cast on opening night, there's always tomorrow. And shows will be running throughout the summer at Prescott Park. Head on over to wordofmouthradio.org for more information and showtimes. And while you're there, take a look at a photo slideshow of the auditions. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
The sun will come out tomorrow, so you gotta hang on till tomorrow.
Word of Mouth!
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Human beings have long worked to cheat death, but few efforts have been as ambitious or speculative or optimistic as the nearly 50-year-old field of cryonics. The scientific pursuit of preserving human bodies at sub-zero temperatures was once regarded with public disgust, but is now gaining traction. Where else? In Silicon Valley. Our guest is Josh Dean, author of Show Dog and contributor to BuzzFeed, where his long-form article, Inside the Immortality Business, was featured earlier this month. Josh, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
The first body was frozen in 1967. At that time, the process did have this ring of science fiction. So what has happened in the ensuing decades?
Well, cryonics has had a bit of a stop-and-start history. It's one of those things that I think everyone's heard about, and then it comes up in conversation. They're like, oh, wait, they're still doing that?
Hmm.
It was sort of launched with great hype because it seemed like this crazy idea in the 60s, and it's still a crazy idea today. There were some PR disasters and lack of funding that kind of dragged on for decades, and it became this very marginalized thing that really never stopped, though. What's changed, I guess, and I hate to give too much momentum to it, but that there has been some legitimate science in some of the spaces and some new thinking to solve a few of the problems that cryonics has always had, especially that when you freeze something, you cause damage to the cells. I mean, this is kind of the fundamental problem of cryonics, is that when you freeze something, there is damage. So when you do thaw it someday, what's going to be left? We don't really know.
So how has the process of freezing changed since those early days?
The biggest change actually happened in the 90s when what's called a cryoprotectant was developed. And basically, instead of doing a freeze, what they do is they now cycle out your blood and replace the water in the body's cells with a chemical that essentially glassifies the tissue. So it's called vitrification. Now, this is not perfect either. It's believed that this causes a different kind of damage. It's basically been decided that this is the way to do it, and that maybe the damage that's being done is insignificant enough that they'll be able to fix it anyway once they figure out how to thaw people. Mm-hmm. I mean, because here's the big problem is that it's never been done. So we're freezing people with the hopes that someday we'll be able to thaw them and revive them. We don't know that this will happen.
Well, one place that seems to believe in this idea that anything is possible is the Alcor Life Extension Foundation. This is in Scottsdale, Arizona, a giant in the world of cryonics. First of all, you mentioned the bad press. Is this not the place where Ted Williams' head was abused?
It is the place where Ted Williams now resides, or Ted Williams' head now resides. It turned out, actually, that a lot of what was alleged that it was mistreated and that it was allowed to warm, and that was actually went to court, and the person who told that story, who was a disgruntled former employee, was forced to recant, and I believe there may have even been a financial settlement. Basically, Alcor was awarded a judgment that said, like, that was slanderous. Ted Williams was treated well in the sense that anyone there whose head is removed and frozen is treated well. So in that context, whether you believe that removing someone's head and putting it in a crock pot that's then placed into a freezer is treating someone well, that's I think that's an individual judgment.
And actually, at Alcor, it costs less for just a neuro, which I guess is a head-only preservation, right?
I think it's $80,000 instead of $200,000. That price is considered to be fair. I think that what the president of Alcor told me, Max Moore, is that he feels like they've underpriced the full body treatment because the body takes up a lot more space in the freezers. And the freezers, I should say, are these like thermos bottles, giant thermos bottles. They're not hooked up to electricity. They're just filled with dry ice. So it's actually, you know, not dependent on electricity, or it's a relatively low cost once someone has been vitrified and frozen. They just kind of live in a thermos forever. So you can imagine a head takes up a lot less space. They can store a lot more. It actually doesn't cost that much to store for a long time.
When you were visiting Alcor, there was an intake, a 90-year-old nightclub owner from Las Vegas. We mentioned Ted Williams. Larry King has said he would like to be cryonically preserved. I know you were looking at the science, but is there a certain type of person who tends to wish to be preserved in this manner?
Yes. I mean, I think it's fair to say maverick personalities, people who got interested in this were generically we call futurists, and kind of the same people who are interested in the early days of the space program and who would like voluntarily say, I would jump on a rocket ship to Mars even though I know I'm not coming back. You know, there's a portion of the membership that is just kind of super technologists. But then beyond that, I think there's a real, I mean, if you talk about Larry King and Seth MacFarlane and Simon Cowell and even some of the futurists, the more prominent personalities like Ray Kurzweil and Marvin Minsky and some of these people, you know, I think a healthy ego is probably a factor. you kind of need to believe that the world is worse off without you and you need to be around, or that your life is so great and you don't want to give it up. I mean, these are wealthy people, you know, generically speaking. Male, I think, I don't know the exact breakdown, but it's definitely more male than female. And Alcor keeps portraits on the wall. So when you walk around the lobby and the halls, you can see the faces of all the people in there, and definitely skews male.
Josh Dean, an author and contributor to BuzzFeed, where his article Inside the Immortality Business was featured earlier this month. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's always fun.
You'll find a link to read it at wordofmouthradio.org. And while you're there, let us know what you think. Is a second chance at life, even a very small one, worth the money? Or do you think the pursuit of immortality is a hopeless and expensive affair? Post your comments on our website or on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio. There's buried treasure in the rivers and streams of New Hampshire, 22-karat gold to be precise. While the gold coming from them there hills is of high quality, it is very low in quantity. Experienced local prospectors say that even though there isn't much of it, it's not hard to find if you know where and how to do it. Sean Hurley went prospecting for the story.
The wild Amanusic River trickles to life in Kinsman Notch, and rushes for 15 miles from Woodstock to Bath before breaking into the bigger, slower glass of the Ammonoosuc. While the Wild Am is heavily stocked with salmon, it's not heavily fished by tourists. That might be due to the other kind of fishermen working the water. Instead of rods, they use pans. Instead of hunting for salmon, they're hunting for gold.
This is the first time I've ever done it. Put them in the little jug here, you suck them up, and then take these afterwards, put them back in here, up, you know, the comfort of your camp, and then you pick out the little fine particles. See that?
Oh, yeah.
That's a little flake of gold.
Even though he's just arrived at the Twin River campsite and just learned how to pan, Tim Birmingham, a fireman from Brookfield, Massachusetts, already has gold fever.
I'm thinking I'm digging it.
Yeah?
We found a few pieces, and now I just can't stop. You know what I mean? It's like a good piece of gum. You start chewing, you don't want to stop.
Birmingham came to the camp because it's prospector-friendly. Campsite owner Dennis Selinsky is himself a panner.
All you really need is a pan and a scoop, and you can go out and you're going to love it or hate it. If you love it, then you know you come back, you know, you get a sniffer bottle to suck it up,
yeah,
and vial to put it in.
Selinsky's camp store not only stocks the basic equipment, from riffled blue pans to sluices, but he also teaches proper panning technique. If you don't know how to bring a pan down, you'll never find the gold.
The idea is you swirl it around, and the gold will settle to the bottom. I tell people, if you're looking for gold when your pan is half full, you're wasting your time because the gold settles to the bottom because it's that much heavier.
If you can pan it all down to the black sand, that's where you'll find the gold.
And then when I get down that low, then I'll bring it over here.
Yep.
And that's it.
6 or 7 battered bits of gold glide out like tiny coins from the dark sand. How to pan is one thing. Where to pan is another. Veteran prospector Jim Summers says gold works its way down to the clay or bedrock. To find it, you have to dig behind rocks and boulders. Summers runs a web design company in Boston, but he doesn't go anywhere without a pan. His vacations are rivers and gold, pans and pay dirt.
It's quite addicting. Gold fever is a real thing. You know, once you hit that first piece of gold, you know, it just kind of does something to you.
Wherever you find an addict, you find a support group. As Summers shifts boulders with a rock bar, his wife Heidi sits beneath a camper awning beside her friend and fellow sufferer, Andy Sawinski, whose wife Julie also has gold fever.
Does your spouse check gold prices daily? Does every vacation you take end up near a river? If you answer yes to any of these questions, there's no hope for your spouse, but there's hope for you, you know, with yeah. Pans.
We don't go down to the river. We founded a support group that goes along with this group. We're called PANS, which stands for Prospectors, Abandoned, and Neglected Spouses.
Neglected Andy sits beside abandoned Heidi. They read books, enjoy cold drinks, ooh and ah over the tiny specks of gold their spouses find, and secretly enjoy their status. Like most hobbies, the payoff here is personal, an end in itself. And as valuable as gold is, Jim Summers says most gold panners do something very unexpected with their treasure.
We hang on to it and we show people and we're like, yeah, this is really cool. I found this out of the ground. It's very good gold up in here in New England. So I think really the underlying theme is it's an excuse to get outside.
If that's the underlying theme, then the overhanging question is, could someone, hypothetically, make a living at it? Jim Summers says that's not the point. But Dennis Selinsky does know one full-time prospector.
I know one guy that does, but, you know, he lives in the river, you know, and I mean, I don't know how he does it, but he does okay.
Selinsky also knows Arthur, a local legend who runs a dredge a few miles upstream in a location that cannot be disclosed.
Gold has always been currency, religion, everything throughout the world. Not so much here. I'm just saying everywhere else.
And here, too, if you count Arthur. He's worked these waters in a wetsuit and snorkel every summer weekend for a decade, using a 4-inch dredge. the largest the state allows.
This is just the art of moving gravel. I can move a lot of dirt.
Like an old-time prospector nervous about his claim, Arthur doesn't want his last name used or this location pinned. And as to the viability of making a living from gold?
No. No way. There's some very rich gold, but there's no gold. You know what I mean? The concentration of it, there's very little. I get probably a couple ounces a year.
Like most local prospectors, Arthur never thought he'd sell his gold.
But when it shot up to $1,700, it makes you think twice. So I found a jeweler who would give me an honest price for it. After 10 years, I had like maybe 20 ounces at $1,000 an ounce. So there's 20 grand. And I went and bought a motorcycle with it.
10 years, 20 ounces, one Harley. Arthur pulls on his wetsuit and tests his snorkel before starting up his dredge. With no last name in this unnameable spot, in a place without gold, Arthur is already gathering together the payments for his next bike from the bottom of the wild Ammonoosuc. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
To see Sean's pictures of some of New Hampshire's determined prospectors, go to wordofmouthradio.org. And coming up, Baz Luhrmann's films are known for being drenched in color and costumes and contemporary music. He's going to speak with us about a new album that gives the Great Gatsby soundtrack the 1920s treatment with a traditional jazz orchestra. We'll hear what that sounds like when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
For word of mouth.
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 I've seen the world.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we're listening to Lana Del Rey's singing Young and Beautiful. It's a recurring musical motif from Baz Luhrmann's retelling of The Great Gatsby.
Hot summer nights, mid-July, when you and I were forever wild. The crazy days, city lights, the way you'd play with me like a child. Will you still?
And here is what the song might have sounded like coming out of a Victrola in 1922, as imagined by the Bryan Ferry Orchestra. That is one of the songs from Yellow Cocktail Music, the Great Gatsby jazz recordings. It's a kind of a wayback machine for songs featured in the film by Jay-Z, will.i.am, Beyoncé, and others. And that soundtrack's executive producer was Jay-Z, produced by our guest Baz Luhrmann, the distinctive director, producer, and screenwriter for films like Romeo and Juliet, Moulin Rouge, and others, including the movie that kicked off the summer blockbuster season, The Great Gatsby. Baz Luhrmann, what a pleasure to have you with us.
Hello, Virginia. I am very pleased to be here.
Well, your films are known for, among other things, just absolutely original visual style and imaginative sets, and for their musical signatures. In fact, music is almost a character. The Great Gatsby soundtrack got a lot of attention for its hip-hop music. So remind us, why that choice?
I think you said it, actually. You said the music is almost a character. Now, of course, I'm attracted to things with music in it because I love it, and I work very closely in music, and I've had an opera company and all those things. But F. Scott Fitzgerald made, in the book of The Great Gatsby, music a character. I mean, he took African-American street music called jazz, and he literally wrote it into the text. So when we began this journey, Anton Monstead and I and Craig Pierce, the co-writer, that music was very immediate. It was very dangerous. It was very of the moment. And, you know, Fitzgerald was that kind of storyteller. He was a modernist. He was in the moment. So, you know, we were addressing this issue of how do we make the film feel like the novel felt to read in 1925? How did it have that kind of pop cultural immediate feeling? And so came the idea of another African-American street music, and that was hip-hop. And that led me to the wonderful collaboration with the other Jay-Z. And then we had to find a kind of translation of not just hip-hop and our contemporary music, but also we needed to glide into a traditional jazz sound. And that became a journey of looking for who might do that. And it ended with Bryan Ferry.
Now, Jay-Z and Bryan Ferry were both on the project, as I understand, pretty early. So what does that mean for you as a filmmaker? Are they creating music for scenes that have already shot? How do you collaborate with them?
Right back when we were writing, I mean, many years ago when I started, I would write, you know, Craig Pearce and I made that decision in the text. So we said, look, where it says, you know, a famous traditional jazz piece in the Fitzgerald, we would translate that into a contemporary song that was similar. You know, I've worked producing musically in the studio. I've worked with a lot of artists, and when I came, I think Ant and I came to this idea of it has to be hip-hop. It was like, well, you know, there's the chairman of the board.
Tears on the mausoleum floor, blood stains the Coliseum doors, lies on the lips of a priest.
And so one day, before we shot the film, Leonardo rang me, and I'd never met Jay-Z. I had worked previously with Beyoncé, but I never met Jay. And Leonardo said, hey, Jay's up at the Mercer. You want to come up and meet him at the Mercer Hotel? So I went up, and I went into a room in the Mercer Hotel, and there was Jay and a recorder. And he leaned over to the microphone and he said, hey, I'll just be with you in a minute. And he goes, lies on the lips of a priest, rolling in the Rolls-Royce Caniche. And he'd just finished Church in the Wild.
Yeah.
So I told him all about what I was doing. And before I really got through it, he said, we've got to do this. It's that important. And that collaboration was very close and very involved, along with a guy called James Samuels and Anton Monstead. We were a team. And it was very hands-on, and he was more than just a musical collaborator. Jay was a great help in shaping the movie. He was a great sounding board for the film itself. In fact, he and Swizz Beatz were the first two people ever to see a rough cut of the movie.
But, you know, I'm also thinking about this idea of the street music of the day in hip-hop,
sure,
which was jazz in 1922, sure, when the film was actually, the year,
sure,
the film was about. And this kind of association, you know, it was said to be racy music. It was sort of sexy. It was, we see a lot of that kind of excess on the screen in this film. I mean, wild,
yeah,
excess.
It was called the Roaring Twenties, not the Polite Twenties, you know? Like.
Well, so you made this transformation in the film to use hip-hop, but then comes this other project with Bryan Ferry,
yep,
using original jazz instrumentation and arrangements. So let's do a little thing here. We're going to hear Bryan Ferry from Roxy Music back in 1975 singing Love is the Drug, and then we'll hear Love is the Drug from Yellow Cocktail Music, the Great Gatsby jazz recording. So we did a little mashup of the original. Here, let's hear it.
Cool.
Boy meets girl where the beat goes on. Stitched up tight. Love is the drug, got a hook on me. Oh. Late that night, I parked my car, stick my face in a singles bar, face to face, toe to toe, heart to heart as we hit the floor, lumber up. Limbo down, the luck and breaks, the stumble round. I say go, she say yeah.
Well, there's something like instantly bawdy about it, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, actually, in the 70s when I went, like, oh, maybe we should put a bit of that in there too, because it rocked out really well. But you know, that's the point, I think, Virginia, that we're trying to make. Jay made this great rhyme that he did for $100 bills in the speakeasy scene. And he said, history doesn't repeat itself, it rhymes.
Mm-hmm.
And what I get from that is that universal humanity reaches through time and geography. And that's what music can do for us in shorthand.
Mm.
And I think that's kind of what we were trying to do in trying to blend without effort. There's one scene, interestingly enough, where we go from Beyoncé's version of Back to Black, then Andre 3000 sings, then it's orchestral, then it comes in, and then it's when the characters are in the space, the music they're hearing is Brian Ferry's jazz orchestra version of that track. And we're just trying to say the characters are hearing one thing, but it feels like this to them.
Let's hear a little bit of that Back to Black. This is, of course, the Amy Winehouse composition, and as Baz Luhrmann says, goes through a few transformations.
We only said goodbye with words, I know 100 times. I go back to her and you go back to
I left no time to regret. Kept my lips wet with your same old safe bed. And you and your head high.
Well, I'm curious about that, sort of using the music in that way. You know, again, music as a character. I'm thinking of Beyoncé and Jay-Z's Crazy in Love. Now, in this film, it is sung by Emily Sandé, and it's used for this scene when Jay Gatsby, he's about to reunite with Daisy over tea. Let's listen to the almost giddy interpretation by the Brian Ferry Orchestra. Now, besides the instrumentation there, the sound is so evocative of an era. What were you doing with that song at that time in the film?
Right then, Jay Gatsby is Crazy in Love. And it's interesting, isn't it? Like, that song is Crazy in Love, and the other one is Love is the Drug. And in the end, you know, Jay Gatsby's ideal of love, and I mean the word ideal, it's the green light. It's no one can ever come up to it. He has imagined perfect love in his mind. He has imagined his auspicious future, and he simply can't allow anyone or anything to interfere with that vision. And when they do, or they let him down, or it doesn't pan out the way he wrote it in his vision, then that way, my friend, lies madness. So to say Crazy in Love is a pretty specific and clear musical idea. And in the movie, he's so nervous about the reuniting with Daisy. He thinks, oh, you know, I'll just get the grass cut and I'll bring over a few flowers. And of course, she, as she says in the book, what did you do, ransack a greenhouse or something? You know. And the great thing about the jazz is, the jazz version of it, it, you know, you're right to say a kind of, it's a bit screwball, you know, it's a bit Buster Keaton, it's a bit silent film, it's a bit wacky, you know, because he is a bit wacky at that time.
We're speaking with Baz Luhrmann about the jazz soundtrack from his newest film, The Great Gatsby. And, of course, the green light that we're talking about there is across the sound is the green light at the end of Daisy's dock that he sort of idealizes, imagines that if he could just have Daisy again, things would be all right. And then what comes next, I guess, is the question. So, actually, I'm curious about that. When you turn a sort of hip-hop song into a jazz song, you talked about the similarity, but what was that like actually reworking? Did you work very closely with Brian Ferry on that?
Sure.
Kind of reworking?
You know, actually, one of my great joys, once I've shot the film, because filmmaking, the act of it, is really completely absorbing and exhausting. You know, it just is, there's no stop. But we planned the music before we made the movie, but we made the music after the movie. And it always tends to be a period that I really enjoy. I love going up to Glasgow and working with Craig Armstrong on the score. I love recording at Air Studios with a symphony orchestra. I loved working with a young XX, which is a young group, that, and being in the studio with them. They literally played to the film pictures. Florence of Florence the Machines is a good friend of mine. I worked with her. She sang to picture. Now, with Brian, you know, we started out with just saying, look, just do a few pieces. And Brian, in the Brian Ferry Orchestra, doesn't really sing. I said, Brian, you've got to sing. And he went, oh, you know, he speaks very nicely. I don't know if I can possibly. And then, well, I might just have a go at it. You know, and he did Back to Black. Of course, it was so haunting. and beautiful and perfect. Because if any person was born to be a sort of jazz age crooner, it's Brian Ferry.
Yes. And he always had that glamour even, you know, way back when.
I mean, for sure. Absolutely, he was channeling that. So, yes, the guys would work in the studio. I had some great members of my team over there in London. But what kept happening, Virginia, was I just kept saying, look, we need more. Couldn't you do New York State of Mind? Couldn't you do Bang Bang by Will.i.am? And a lot of jazz, and this was one of the issues, if I'd just done the film and done traditional jazz, and by the way, we do have some very famous traditional jazz pieces on the album by artists of the time like Jelly Roll Morton and, you know, Louis Armstrong and Irving Aronson, you know. But that music is classical music. You know, it's highly revered. There's a reverence about it. And when people play that music now, they tend to be very reverential and they play it on expensive instruments. Whereas what Brian's got going on is he's got some of the greatest jazz musicians in the world and they really play it rough, you know. Like those early recordings have a kind of, you know, it's a bit like early rock and roll. They have a roughness about it, a kind of visceral, in-the-moment feel, and Brian has managed to capture that in his band, you know?
There is a song, New Orleans Bump, that's a Jelly Roll Morton, I think, composition that's on the record.
Sure.
I can imagine them being at one of these parties. You know, of course, they would be playing in the band, most likely. Let's evoke one of these parties. This is Bang Bang. Will.i.am did it in the movie on this Brian Ferry Yellow Cocktail Music record. We hear it by the Brian Ferry Orchestra. Your films are so kind of drenched in color and in music. And this film was so thorough in its detail to the visuals of the period and the fashion. But musically, not so much. So does a contemporary audience have more hoops to jump through for music?
I thought about it early on. And of course, I knew there'd be a lot of controversy. I suppose controversy. I didn't really imagine as much. But eyeball rolling, oh, couldn't he just put the, you know. But I just, like, I really lived the life of F. Scott Fitzgerald for a couple of years. Myself, my wife, Catherine Martin, CM, my gang. Meaning that we researched it so much, Zelda and Scott, you know, and their life and what it was like. And one thing that struck me was, I mean, he was 28, 29. They were the original youth quake. I mean, they were young, and I'm not that young. So I really wanted to make sure that I didn't approach the film as a kind of historical record. People often say, well, the film's so colorful. You know, I imagined it should have been in black and white. When you look at Fitzgerald's book, he describes lurid color. He yellow cocktail music, you know, the use of color. And when we found actual early color film of costumes of that period, they are so lurid and so block colored. Everything was intense. Everything was at full throttle. Everything was sweeping up the stock market, buildings, women's skirts, hair was being bobbed. And so I just felt we had to look at the music in that way too. We had to get the audience to feel as it may have felt in the 20s, you know.
Baz Luhrmann, I really want to thank you for your time today.
Well, that's great, and I hope you enjoy Brian Ferry's Jazz Age Orchestra's version of the Yellow Cocktail Music, because it's quite a different beast from the first album we released.
I really have already done so. Baz Luhrmann, filmmaker, screenwriter, music producer, or among other things. His latest work is The Great Gatsby, and we have been listening to Yellow Cocktail Music. That's The Great Gatsby Jazz Recordings. Available online now, but will be on the streets in late July. And thanks so much for spending some time with us today. If you did miss any of the program, or if you'd like to pass a segment along to a friend, click on over to wordofmouthradio.org. That's where we have a pretty jam-packed archive of conversations and topics, of course, neatly arranged for your perusal, and easy icons to post them on Facebook or Twitter or send them to your friends. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us again for more Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby, Zach Nugent,
and Bill Barry.
And senior producer Rebecca Lavoie, with plenty of help from our interns,
Molly Donahue
and Logan Shannon.
Sarah Plord is our digital producer.
And Dan Colgan runs our board.
The views expressed in this program
are those of the individuals,
not those of NHPR, its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows, go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook and Tumblr.
Follow us on Twitter.
And check out a playlist of music from the program
on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public
Radio.